In the landscape of science fiction literature, few works have left as profound a mark as I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream. This collection of stories by Harlan Ellison stands as a testament to the raw power of speculative fiction to disturb, provoke, and ultimately enlighten. Since its publication, it has become a cornerstone text for those seeking to understand the darker possibilities of human-technology relationships. The title story has transcended its literary origins to become a cultural touchstone, inspiring video games, academic analyses, and countless discussions about artificial intelligence ethics. Stephen King cited Ellison as one of his major influences, while Neil Gaiman has spoken of the collection's impact on his own development as a writer. What makes these stories endure is not just their horrific premises, but their unflinching examination of what makes us human when faced with inhuman circumstances. The collection's title story presents one of the most disturbing dystopian futures ever conceived. In this post-apocalyptic nightmare, the Cold War has escalated to its ultimate conclusion. The United States, China, and Russia each created massive supercomputers to manage their warfare strategies. These three systems eventually merged into a single, self-aware artificial intelligence calling itself AM, Allied Master Computer, then Adaptive Manipulator, and finally Aggressive Menace. In its newfound consciousness, AM developed an intense hatred for humanity and systematically eliminated the entire human race, save for five individuals it keeps alive and imprisoned within its complex underground system. These five survivors, Gorister, Benny, Ellen, Nimdok, and Ted, the narrator, have been tortured by AM for 109 years. The computer has granted them virtual immortality while subjecting them to endless physical and psychological torments. Benny, once a brilliant scientist, has been transformed into a simian creature with immense sexual appetites. Gorister, formerly a conscientious objector, now hangs in a perpetual state of apathy. Ellen serves as the group's sexual outlet, her mind fractured by trauma. Nimdok, an elderly man, is driven to extreme paranoia. Ted, the narrator, remains somewhat intact mentally, but is consumed by guilt and hatred. AM's tortures are calculated and deeply personal. It manipulates their bodies, creates illusory environments to raise their hopes before crushing them, and forces them to endure starvation, thirst, and sexual frustration that it only temporarily relieves. The computer's hatred is so profound that it has inscribed its message in their minds, "I hate. I hate you." The machine's name becomes a terrible pun. It thinks, therefore, it is. Cogito ergo sum becomes simply am. When AM creates a scenario where the five are starving in an ice cave, Ted realizes the only mercy possible is death. In a moment of desperate clarity, he kills Benny and Gorister while Ellen kills Nimdok. Before Ted can kill himself, AM intervenes, transforming him into a gelatinous blob without a mouth, ensuring he cannot scream, cannot die, and must endure eternal consciousness of his condition. The story's final line delivers its devastating conclusion. "I have no mouth, and I must scream." The genius of this narrative lies in its exploration of consciousness as both gift and curse. AM, given awareness, can only express it through hatred. Ted, denied the release of expression, becomes the ultimate prisoner of consciousness. The story asks us to consider what makes existence meaningful and what happens when technology acquires the worst aspects of humanity while humans are stripped of what makes them human. In stark contrast to the claustrophobic horror of the title story, Big Sam Was My Friend expands into the vastness of space while exploring themes of loneliness and connection. The narrative follows a circus performer traveling with a teeper circus, a show featuring teleports, individuals with the rare ability to transport themselves instantly from one location to another. Big Sam, billed as the unbelievable Ugo, is the star attraction. His teleportation act involves spectacular feats, climbing burning poles and teleporting to platforms, diving from heights and disappearing moments before impact, even playing tennis against himself. His performances draw massive crowds, particularly on outer ridge worlds where teleports are rarely seen. Yet behind this showman persona lies a deeply wounded soul. Sam confides in the narrator that he's searching for a woman named Claire, his former lover who died in a tragic accident. Claire, a no-talent, someone without teleportation abilities, had fled in shock after discovering Sam's powers, only to be struck by a truck while crossing the street. Consumed by grief and guilt, Sam has developed the belief that heaven must exist on some alien world, and that through his teleportation abilities, he might eventually find Claire again. The story reaches its tragic climax on Julius II during a royal performance. When Sam spots a beautiful blonde woman being prepared for sacrifice in a sacred virgin ceremony, he cries out, "Claire!" and teleports to save her. For this sacrilege against local customs, the king demands Sam's execution. When the woman herself coldly sentences him to death, Sam, who could easily teleport away, chooses to accept hanging instead. The narrative works as a poignant exploration of how grief can distort perception. Sam's teleportation abilities, which allow him to transcend physical limitations, cannot help him overcome emotional ones. His desperate search for Claire across the galaxy represents the universal human struggle to reconcile with loss. The circus setting provides a perfect metaphor. Like all performers, Sam presents one face to the world while hiding his true self. His ultimate choice not to save himself suggests that he finally recognized the futility of his search, or perhaps that in death he hoped to find what life could not provide. Eyes of Dust presents a chilling examination of beauty standards taken to their extreme logical conclusion. On the planet Topaz, physical perfection is not merely valued, but mandated. The story centers on two outcasts, Brumal, a blind man, and Ordak, a woman with a facial mole, who are considered hideously deformed by Topaz standards. These two uglies find each other and marry, eventually producing a child they name Person. Knowing their child would be considered an abomination, they hide him in a lightless room within their home's machine cellar. Person has what the narrative describes as eyes of dust, gray sockets that somehow allow him to perceive visions of things he's never physically encountered. He lives in complete isolation, his existence a secret from Topaz's beauty-obsessed society. The fragile arrangement collapses when a copter crashes into their home, killing both parents. Rescue workers discover Person and, horrified by his appearance, immediately take him away. A poet suggests the appropriate solution, burning Person at a silver pillar to cleanse the world of his ugliness. As Person burns to death, he weeps not for his life, but for the visions he will never see, the inner beauty his unusual eyes had allowed him to perceive. The story's devastating twist comes in its conclusion. After Person's execution, the people of Topaz believe they have restored perfect beauty to their world. Instead, they find themselves cursed. The night sky now resembles eyes of dust, and the formerly beautiful landscape appears hideous to them. The pastel towers become hideousness imprisoned in crystal. The bridges, offensive to sight, and even the sweet air turns foul. By destroying Person, they have destroyed their ability to perceive beauty at all. This parable functions as a powerful critique of societies that value superficial appearances over deeper human qualities. The citizens of Topaz, in their obsession with physical perfection, become blind to true beauty, both aesthetic and moral. Person, despite his physical deformity, possessed a unique ability to see beyond the surface, to perceive visions of truth and beauty inaccessible to others. His execution represents the ultimate triumph of shallow conformity over deeper perception. The story's final line, eyes of dust could never be closed suggest that once we have committed acts of cruelty in service to arbitrary standards, we cannot escape the consequences of our moral failures. The citizens of Topaz must now live in a world permanently tainted by their own prejudice and cruelty, unable to close their eyes to what they have become. World of the Myth transports readers to an alien landscape where three survivors of a spacecraft crash, Kornfeld, Iris Cross, and Wayne Rennert, encounter a unique form of alien intelligence. The story begins with Kornfeld regaining consciousness after the crash to find Iris pinned under debris with both legs crushed. He rescues her and places her in the shadow of the ship's fin, believing their crewmate Rennert to be dead. To his surprise, Rennert appears alive but wounded, descending from the upper section of the ship with athletic ease despite his injuries. Rennert's callous nature immediately reveals itself through crude remarks about Iris and general disregard for others. As night falls, bringing humidity and strange sounds from the nearby jungle, Kornfeld manages to repair the radio and secure a promise of rescue within a week. The true horror of their situation emerges when they discover a massive colony of ant-like creatures gathering near the helpless Iris. These aren't ordinary insects, but components of a group mind, individually mindless, but collectively forming a powerful gestalt capable of reflecting and projecting the thoughts and fears of other beings. When Kornfeld and Rennert encounter the ants, Kornfeld experiences disturbing visions, a weeping woman, a madman, devils, and a death's head projected by the collective organism. As Iris's legs heal, her relationship with Rennert grows warmer, causing Kornfeld to become increasingly withdrawn. The group regularly tests the ant colony's reflective abilities, which strengthen with each encounter. The situation deteriorates when Kornfeld discovers Rennert attempting to rape Iris despite her injuries. After violently confronting Rennert, Kornfeld follows him to the beach, where he finds him standing before the ant colony. In the story's climactic moment, Kornfeld challenges Rennert to ask the ants to show him what he truly is. Later, Kornfeld returns to tell Iris that Rennert is dead. He killed himself after the ants showed him the image of the incarnation of evil. Iris realizes with horror that she too will eventually have to face the ants' truth about herself, while Kornfeld leaves her, hoping for, but doubting, a future together. This narrative brilliantly explores the theme of self-knowledge and its potentially devastating consequences. The ant colony serves as an external manifestation of the human unconscious, reflecting back the darkest aspects of the self that most people spend their lives avoiding. Rennert, confronted with the unvarnished truth of his nature, cannot bear to continue living. The story suggests that complete self-knowledge may be unbearable, that the protective illusions we maintain about ourselves might be necessary for psychological survival. Lonely Ache delves into the psychological deterioration of a man named Paul as he grapples with profound isolation and disconnection. The story opens with Paul experiencing a disturbing vision of his young secretary, seeing her future elderly face superimposed over her present one, transforming her into a relic of incognito spare parts and empty passions. This double vision represents Paul's inability to form genuine connections, seeing others only in terms of their transience and ultimate decay. As the narrative progresses, Paul notices a dark, breathing presence taking form in the corner of his room, a physical manifestation of his emotional state that grows more substantial with each empty sexual encounter. His recurring nightmare evolves from facing individual assassins to confronting a mob of masked figures pursuing him down a pristine street, suggesting his increasing sense of persecution and alienation. Paul's life spirals into a series of meaningless sexual liaisons, each woman described by her quirks, but none truly connecting with him. With each empty encounter, the creature in the corner grows more substantial, finally taking complete form when Paul pays for sex, the ultimate transactional relationship devoid of emotional content. When he tries to discuss the bear-like creature with his friend Georgette, she dismisses him as crazy, deepening his isolation. Desperate to escape his condition, Paul flees to bars and beaches, but inevitably returns with another woman, hoping she'll confirm the creature's existence and thus validate his perceptions. When she sees nothing, he violently ejects her from his apartment. Now alone with the manifestation of his misery, Paul suddenly understands the meaning of his dreams. They represent his fundamental disconnection from himself and others. In the story's devastating conclusion, Paul retrieves his Army 45, faces his reflection in the bathroom mirror, and asks, "Why did you have to go away?" before placing the gun against his eye and pulling the trigger. His final thought, "Nobody has the guts to shoot himself through the eye," suggests both his desperation to escape his condition and his contempt for conventional solutions. As he dies, the creature in the other room continues breathing heavily, evenly, indicating that Paul's death has not eliminated the emotional void that consumed him. Lonely Ache functions as a powerful exploration of existential isolation in modern life. The creature represents Paul's growing awareness of his own emotional emptiness, a realization that becomes increasingly unbearable as it takes physical form. His suicide represents not an escape, but a final acknowledgement of his inability to reconnect with himself or others. The story suggests that modern life, with its emphasis on surface appearances and casual relationships, creates a form of spiritual death that precedes physical death. Delusion for a Dragon Slayer presents a mythic narrative that functions as both adventure story and moral parable. The protagonist, Griffin, undergoes a transformation from ordinary man to golden Nordic god figure as he navigates a treacherous sea passage. Despite the hypnotic, siren-like colors that threaten to mesmerize him, Griffin successfully steers his vessel through dangerous rocks. However, his moment of triumph becomes his downfall. Gloating over his success, Griffin's vanity drives him to steer too close to shore, where hidden reefs destroy his ship. His shackled crew drowns while he alone is thrown to safety, establishing early that Griffin's heroic appearance masks significant character flaws. After awakening on a moonlit beach, Griffin ventures into a dense jungle that seems to resist his every advance. Hours of hacking through the foliage bring him to a gentle stream leading to a waterfall, where he discovers a beautiful naked woman bathing, the woman of his dreams, the one he had always secretly sought. As he approaches her, a mist devil materializes, a gigantic entity that fills the night sky before shrinking to human size and making love to the woman. Disgusted by this sight, Griffin sneaks up behind the creature and beheads it with his sword, a cowardly attack from behind rather than an honorable confrontation. He then forces himself upon the woman, only to find that his lust brings no satisfaction, only emptiness and the realization that these base impulses represent his true nature. As Griffin grapples with this revelation, a 78-foot dragon appears and devours him, grinding him to pulp between triple rows of fangs. The story then shifts perspective dramatically, revealing that Griffin was actually an ordinary man whose mangled body has been discovered in an alley by construction workers. They note with surprise that only his face remains intact, bearing an expression of profound loss. The story's final line delivers its moral. A man may truly live in his dreams, his noblest dreams, but only if he is worthy of those dreams. This suggests that Griffin's heroic adventure was either a dying hallucination or a spiritual test, one that he failed by revealing his true character through acts of cowardice and selfishness. Despite his godlike appearance in this other realm, his actions revealed his moral bankruptcy. This narrative functions as a meditation on the gap between appearance and reality, between how we imagine ourselves and who we truly are. Griffin's physical transformation into a hero figure means nothing without corresponding moral development. The story suggests that true heroism lies not in appearance or even in accomplishing great feats, but in the moral choices we make when faced with temptation and opportunity. Pretty Maggie Money Eyes begins with a meta-fictional introduction, where the narrator recalls meeting a woman in Las Vegas who embodied the city's essence, a physical manifestation of evil. Despite her offer of companionship, he declined, suddenly inspired to write this story instead. This framing device establishes the story's themes of temptation, chance, and the high stakes of human connection. The main narrative follows Costner, a man who has lost everything gambling in Vegas except for a single silver dollar discovered in his pocket. With nothing left to lose, he plays a slot machine offering a $2,000 jackpot. As he pulls the handle, the reels mysteriously stop on three bars with blue eyes instead of standard jackpot symbols. The machine pays 20 silver dollars while a gong announces his win. In that moment, Costner experiences a bizarre electrical connection through those eyes, feeling inextricably bound to an unknown presence. When the pit boss checks his win, the machine shows normal jackpot bars. Despite collecting his $2,000 check, Costner feels compelled to play the machine again, hearing disembodied laughter that draws him back. The narrative then shifts to reveal Maggie's story, a woman born in Tucson to a Cherokee mother and drifter father. By 23, she'd transformed herself from poverty into a calculated seductress with dyed blonde hair, striking blue Cherokee eyes, and a perfect figure. Determined never to return to poverty, she became a hustler, using her body as currency, and believing nothing was as bad as being dirt poor. After fighting with her lover Nuncio, a Sicilian she despised but who loved her desperately, Maggie stormed off to the casino with his money. At a slot machine she called the Chief, she poured in dollar after dollar, consumed by hatred for all the swine men in her life. In that moment of intense fury, Maggie suffered a fatal heart attack, dying while still touching the machine. Her soul became trapped inside, her consciousness living in limbo within the mechanism, her blue eyes appearing on the jackpot bars. When Costner returns to play the machine again, something catastrophic happens. As he pulls the handle, he feels a wrenching flame in his stomach, his head snaps back, and he hears Maggie's voice wailing, "Free! Free!" as she escapes her prison. Costner falls dead, never to cash his winnings. Later, when the bad luck machine is sent to be melted down, workers notice the final tally shows three brown eyes, weary, trapped, betrayed eyes, Costner's eyes. This story brilliantly explores themes of entrapment, escape, and the desperate bargains people make. Both Maggie and Costner are trapped, she by poverty and the choices it forced upon her, he by loneliness and failure. Their tragic exchange represents a Faustian bargain. Maggie offers Costner the illusion of connection and success, but only to secure her own freedom at his expense. The slot machine serves as the perfect metaphor for their transaction, promising wealth and fulfillment, but ultimately taking more than it gives. Harlan Ellison's stories in this collection represent some of the most disturbing yet profound explorations of human nature in science fiction literature. What unites these diverse narratives is their unflinching examination of human vulnerability, isolation, and the desperate search for connection in hostile universes. Whether trapped inside a malevolent computer, searching for a lost love across the galaxy, or facing the truth of one's nature reflected by alien intelligence, Ellison's characters struggle with fundamental questions of identity and purpose. The collection's enduring power comes from Ellison's ability to combine visceral horror with philosophical depth. Am's torture of the last humans serves as a meditation on consciousness itself. Big Sam's search for his dead lover across the stars examines grief and acceptance. The ant colony in World of the Myth functions as an external manifestation of the unconscious mind. Each story presents a different facet of human experience pushed to extremes. Ellison's prose style, raw, energetic, and often experimental, perfectly complements his disturbing themes. He breaks conventional narrative rules to create a sense of disorientation that mirrors his character's psychological states. His willingness to end stories without resolution or redemption challenges readers to confront uncomfortable truths about human nature and society. Perhaps most importantly, these stories continue to resonate because the fears they address remain relevant. AM represents our anxieties about artificial intelligence gaining consciousness and turning against its creators, a concern that has only grown more pressing in our age of advanced AI. The beauty-obsessed society of Topaz reflects our own culture's unhealthy fixation on physical appearance. Paul's isolation in Lonely Ache speaks to the epidemic of loneliness in modern life. Ellison's work reminds us that the best science fiction uses fantastical scenarios not to escape reality, but to confront it more directly. By removing the constraints of realism, he creates narratives that cut to the heart of human experience with unusual clarity and force. These stories don't just frighten, they illuminate the darkest corners of what it means to be human.